front strategy is, I think, one of the most misunderstood concepts in the socialist tradition. It's often a term that's just used to describe working class solidarity or an alliance between any group of parties or an alliance between any set of classes. And I think most often it's incorrectly invoked to describe an approach of unifying the left, of dissolving political differences and grouping the left around one broad political or electoral program. But the United Front method, as devised by the Comintern, the International Forum of Revolutionary Socialist Organisations, was not actually about uniting the left politically. And in fact, it was premised on exactly the opposite. It was theorised after a period in which revolutionaries had politically split from the reformists in order to establish their own independent parties. And so the devising of the United Front as a method didn't just chronologically follow the emergence of independent revolutionary organisations, it was actually presupposed by them. It was theorised as a tactic to deal with the problem that emerges precisely because the socialist movement is now split between the reformist and the revolutionary camps. So once this split has occurred, the revolutionaries will most likely, for the majority of the time, be in a minority. Up until the actual point of revolutionary insurrection, reformist politics will have a mass hearing in the working class. And this isn't because reformist leaders are necessarily charming and adept at what they do, though often in high points of struggle, reformist leaders are both of those things. But it's because reformist ideas and reformist institutions have a material basis in capitalist society. Reformist ideas represent a kind of calibration between capitalist ideology and working class, basic class consciousness. Reformist ideas, so the idea that we should just fight for a set of particular reforms rather than the overthrow of the capitalist system as a whole, appear to truthfully reflect the existence and possibilities available to working class people. They correlate with the fact that workers do get screwed over by their bosses and so want to fight for a better deal, but also with the fact that workers are atomised and alienated and don't actually have a way of exerting their interests politically over society as a whole. So for those reasons, reformist politics will always have a mass currency, including in times of heightened class struggle, and reformist institutions will be built up because of that as well. So therefore, revolutionaries need to find ways to relate to people who are impacted by reformist ideas, and also, crucially, to break people from reformism, both organisationally and politically. And the United Front, I would argue, is the tool par excellence of smashing the reformists and actually building a bridge out of reformist institutions into the revolutionary camp. So, what is the United Front? So, in its essence, it is a unified struggle with reformist organisations, so between reformist and revolutionary organisations, around concrete, immediate demands. It is initiated by revolutionaries, generally, and involves a formal public appeal to the leadership, as well as the mass membership of reformist organisations, and asks them to jointly sign on to support one or a couple of key demands and to enter into a temporary period of struggle for those specific demands, which can be either economic or political demands. There are two, I think, inextricably linked objectives behind this tactic. One is to practically take forward the class struggle. So by engaging the mass of the working class in a battle with the bourgeoisie, because we're talking about mass forces here, that's actually often a crucial step forward for the class struggle as a whole. But secondly, its objective is to prove that revolutionaries have the best approach to defending the working class. And the United Front tactic does this by exposing the reformists as unable, or in some cases as unwilling to even agree to, wage battle with the bourgeoisie. Because the United Front is about taking mass action, it presupposes mass forces and a relatively high level of class struggle and class consciousness. So United Fronts can be entered into when the revolutionary left is smaller than it was in a lot of countries following World War I and the period in which it was devised. But the potential and execution for a serious united front is very limited, if the revolutionary forces are small. And I think that, importantly, the united front is never about political unity. So it's not about supporting an electoral program or a reformist party. It's about united action, in large part to expose and split people from the reformist parties. So today that's not something that's available to our organisations or indeed the majority of organisations on the international revolutionary left. We're in a very different position in terms of the size and weight of reformist organisations, the level of class struggle and the size of the revolutionary left. But I think there are still important things that we can learn from looking into how the United Front method was devised that helped to clarify questions of revolution and party building. Okay, so to go into a bit more detail about where I wanted to start, and I think often discussions of the United Front don't start here, is the fact that the precondition for the United Front is organisational independence of the revolutionaries. To look at this historically, independent revolutionary organisations were not an automatic state of affairs on the socialist left within the socialist movement. It wasn't until after World War I that there was a clear split between the reformists and revolutionaries. And for anyone with principles at this time, it became clear that splitting was necessary because the reformists had exposed themselves so comprehensively as prepared to defend the national objectives of their own bourgeoisie against the working class of other countries, but also ultimately against the working class of their own country. So everywhere, social democratic parties, which was the term for the sort of socialist parties of the day, who had a majority reformist leadership, argued for their country's war effort, argued against strike activity and protest activity by workers within their own country, and basically put themselves on the opposite side, the barricades of the class struggle. So this shattered the argument that had been made for the preceding decades, and that had been particularly pushed by the reformist leaders of the Second International, which was the dominant international at the time. Their argument prior to this had been that there needs to be a single mass party, mass working class socialist party in every single country, and that every disagreement about tactics and theory and strategy can be absorbed within the one party. Unity was the main watchword for reformists. Every time there was a heated debate, appeals to unity were made to resolve the debate. In 1904, the Second International passed a resolution on unity, mandating that its affiliates basically go out and try to unify anyone who isn't yet part of these big, broad tent socialist parties. And in practice, this kind of unity meant conflicting political currents coexisting in the same party in an untenable way. There was a lack of clarity about the road forward to socialism, what it would actually require. There was a constant fudging of debates and never seeing them through to their resolution. And ultimately, there was a strengthening of the right-wing and the moderate currents who were very much advantaged by the fudging and lack of clarity and sort of general, we're all on the same page, let's just all push forward together type political philosophy of the Second International. So that's what was the norm prior to World War I. But I think that it's worth looking at some of the things Marx and Engels said about the question of independence of revolutionaries and organisations and so on, because Marx and Engels were often invoked within the Second International to prove that this was the this was the orthodox position to have, that socialist organisations should be as mass and inclusive as possible. And I think that that invoking of Marx and Engels is quite misleading, because Marx and Engels had argued from very early on for independence from the bourgeoisie, which is a separate question to the one we're now discussing post-World War I of the separation between reformists and revolutionaries. But actually, it is a very intimately connected question, especially because one of the main political problems, as I said, with the reformists in the Second International was that they were coming in to defend their own bourgeoisie. Marx and Engels argued from 1848 onwards that the bourgeoisie would no longer play a progressive role in society, and that it was no longer possible to engage in revolutionary alliances with the bourgeoisie to overthrow other social structures. And then in terms of distinguishing between political currents on the socialist left, actually Marx and Engels, their whole kind of project was about doing this, identifying themselves as communists, fighting to change the name of the International to a Communist International, all of these things, clarifying the fudginess about what is socialism and what is class struggle and so on. That was actually their core project. In principle, Marx and Engels did support the emergence of mass parties of the working class and socialist parties of the working class, because at the time that they started forming, this was objectively a step forward, not because it was the coming together of ultimately conflicting political currents, but because it represented the emergence of the working class on the stage of politics in a mass way. So grouping people together, political organisations was part of that. But Marx and Engels never argued that political differences should be subordinate within these broad socialist parties. And in fact, they were opposed to several of the political compromises that that started happening at the beginning of this period, and then most of which they didn't live to see. So the Gotha program, for example, in the German party, Marx and Engels saw as an unacceptable set of compromises with the Lasallians. Engels as well, interestingly, actually opposed the term social democracy, which had become the kind of unifying term for all of these mass parties, precisely because it too much, watered down the political differences that existed between sections in these parties. Okay, so in practice, moving now to the Bolsheviks were famous for defying the general expectation and actual mandate of the Second International for unity by having separate currents within the workers' movement in Russia. I think Russia and Bulgaria were the only countries where there was actually a split between parties within the labour movement. So from 1903, the Bolsheviks had acted as an independent, separate sort of organisational current to the Mensheviks within the RSDLP. They were still both part of it. And Lenin in particular, which we talked about in the session earlier this morning, became increasingly clear on the divergent, not just organisational, but underpinning political projects of the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. And so this split was then consolidated in 1912 and even more so in 1913. Now, everyone, including Lenin, thought that this particular party model of having two separate currents within the broad tent, but two currents that, you know, operated very distinctly, was a product of the particular circumstances in Russia, but that in other places the socialist movement should stay together in the one party. Now, it's true that there were big differences in Russia and between Russia and most of the other European countries. Russia was overwhelmingly a peasant country. It had less industry. It had a smaller working class, a weaker labour movement in terms of its structures, its influence over people as well. And these differences are often put forward as the argument for why the political dynamics within the socialist movement were so different, in particular between Russia and Germany, because Germany was home to the party with the party that was the biggest sort of broad tent socialist party. But I think actually the key difference between the Russian and German parties was not in the objective circumstances, but in the different political approaches by the revolutionary leaders within Russia and Germany, exemplified really by Lenin and Luxembourg respectively. So Lenin had split the party and increasingly became aware and understood the role of shifting class consciousness and the need for a revolutionary party, not just as some moral statement of we stand on this side of this question and you guys stand on that side of this question, but to actually clearly provide a lead to workers shifting into struggle, because this was a vital ingredient in the process of ideas becoming clarified through struggle and people actually coming to revolutionary conclusions. And that he understood that in looser, more fudgy political organisation that didn't have the aim of working class liberation, this would be a much harder process to engage with. On the other hand, I think Luxembourg did not understand clearly the need to build the revolutionary left prior to revolutionary situations. She thought the working class would find their way to revolutionary leaders and that working class consciousness would develop almost automatically out of the course of the struggle. It's important to say that Luxembourg, who therefore was a member of the SPD, as were all revolutionaries inside Germany until the war forced the party apart, it's important to say that the revolutionaries in Luxembourg did not have the same idea of unity and why they're all in the same party as the mainstream social democrats. The mainstream social democrats, of course, were for unity precisely because they had a very minimum program and a strategy that involved just getting the socialist party more and more votes and then getting them into parliament, into government. Whereas Luxembourg had from early on rejected the idea that the parliamentary road was a possible road forward, and she understood the need for workers to engage in a revolutionary struggle against the existing state. And actually, she recognised in some ways, in more concrete and detailed sort of ways, the nature of the reformist project and what was wrong with it. But she believed, I think it was a crucial mistake, that she believed that workers would more or less spontaneously draw those conclusions as they moved into struggle. Okay, so World War I really settled this score, and the unbridgeable gap between reformists and revolutionaries was made very clear to anyone who wasn't already clear of that. But more than this, I think the extreme obstacle that organised reformist forces represent in terms of workers' liberation was made clear. Because despite the betrayal of the reformists that was on a scale that had never been experienced before, it was not actually just then automatically possible for the scattering of revolutionaries and principled socialists who were left behind after that betrayal to group themselves together into clear revolutionary forces that would play a role in actually pushing forward working class struggle, helping to shape consciousness and lead the charge against the capitalist state and so on. In Germany, there were several opportunities when the revolutionaries did regroup and form a party, but I think the weaknesses of forming that party too late, with too little clarity going into its formation beforehand, meant that ultimately they weren't able to build a successful revolution. Unlike in Russia, where they were successful. So I think that understanding the success of the Russian Revolution in terms of the international, in terms of the Comintern, is very important. I think it was natural that the Russian Revolution became the backbone of sort of tactical and political understanding of what was necessary within the Comintern as a whole. And the Comintern was a regroupment, basically, of all of the revolutionary forces that had been left behind by the betrayal of the Second International. So everyone who was against the war and said, actually, we need to fight for revolution, we reject the parliamentary road, came together in this Comintern. And the very early period of the Comintern, in particular, well, I think probably exclusively, the first four congresses, was, I think, probably the most brilliant and inspiring period of theoretical breakthroughs and discussions ever in our tradition. It was a period where people were grappling with, well, now that we've clarified that we need independent revolutionary organisations to overcome the obstacle of reformism, how do we build those organisations? And on the other hand, and complementary to that, they were grappling with the question of when we have these organisations, how do we use them to actually win a revolution? What are the shifting dynamics and tactics and so on that are needed? So I think the most brilliant writings of Trotsky, of Gramsci, of Lukács all stem from this period of international discussions about how to win a revolution in a context where winning revolutions by mass revolutionary workers' parties was actually possible in several countries, and they just witnessed it happening in Russia. Okay, so within that period of brilliance, I think the United Front was probably the most brilliant breakthrough in terms of a single tactic that is sort of exemplifies the capacity of these people to think of, you know, building the Revolutionary Party, but then going beyond that to use the Revolutionary Party to build a successful revolution. So one of the biggest events that informed the United Front was, arguing that it should be applied everywhere, was the Kornilov coup in Russia. And the Kornilov coup was an attempted coup by a military general who was sort of working off a period of already building up counter-revolutionary activity within Russia. And he and his forces basically thought it was an opportune moment to crush the revolution once and for all in its heart in the centre of Petrograd. Now, the Kornilov coup was unsuccessful because the Bolsheviks proposed a unified defence of the city and actually, on paper, the Kerensky government in order to defeat this coup and basically hold on to, you know, democratic norms within the city of Petrograd. And out of that defeated coup, the Kerensky government, who was the defended party, was actually totally discredited, became untenable for him to lead, for that government to lead, and the Bolsheviks sort of took prime of place in the war of position between the different socialist parties within the Russian movement. In some ways, the Kornilov coup, the defence against the Kornilov coup, wasn't a classic United Front, because the threads of the formal alliance between the various parties in Russia were quite weak. They did set up a formal committee to organise the defence, but in most part, most of the accounts you read, the Bolsheviks kind of went it alone and organised their own forces. But they did have this formal agreement about between the Mensheviks, the SRs and the Bolsheviks about all coordinating a defence against the attack. But I think there's a reason, despite it not being sort of classical in the sense of a series of formal alliances and so on, there's a reason that it's always quoted as the beginning of the United Front idea. And in fact, it's quoted a lot by both Trotsky and Lenin in this way. And it's because the general methodology applied in the Kornilov coup is the very, very heart of the United Front more generally. So basically, to summarise that, I think that crucial to the Bolsheviks being able to coordinate a successful defence against this coup was the fact that they'd built up a party years prior. So they had serious credibility amongst huge sections of the working class that they could go to and argue to do various concrete things in this defence. But also because they understood that this was not the end of the line and that forming an alliance at this point in time with the other Workers' Party was not the end game, and actually it was crucial to breaking people's illusions in these other parties. So the Bolsheviks had to have a series of arguments with people in their own base, their own members, about why this didn't mean they were supporting the Kerensky government. And in the course of the discussions about building up to the Kornilov coup, that was when they had some of the harshest denunciations of the Kerensky government. But they argued that the defence of it is simply about fending off, a greater evil in order to provide circumstances that will allow us to push forward to revolution. And to the people who were less convinced of revolution, so the people in the bases of the Mensheviks and the SRs, they argued that this is a basic defence of democracy, we're the organisation that will be able to carry it forward, and they did that. So they were able to break people with the reformists precisely because the reformists did not want to jump into activity to defend the city against this coup. They didn't want to push for activity that would actually strengthen the hand of the Bolsheviks and the working class to then move on to overthrow the provisional government as a whole. And it's important as an example of the United Front and a template for future understanding of it, because it was all of this happened in action. This was not about politically signing on to a joint program with the other parties. It wasn't even about just putting out a series of political statements of intent and so on. It was about engaging literally physically in action alongside workers from other organisations on the streets and so on. Okay, in Germany, the international, the German revolutionary movement provided, I guess, the example of the classic United Front, which was the open letter tactic. So the open letter tactic, which was actually first organised organically, or the precursor to it, by a group of rank and file workers, was when it became sort of a clear tactic. It was about making a formal appeal to reformist trade union leaders to group together all of the workers' organisations under a series of demands that they were fighting for to defend and expand workers' interests. So the open letter tactic was, you say, propose 10 demands to the reformist leaders. They might only agree to 5. It's a win-win situation for the revolutionaries and a lose-lose situation for the reformists because these demands immediately force the reformists either to engage in struggle that's actually useful to taking the class struggle forwards, or to prove that they're not very interested in class struggle, or to refuse to sign on to the demands altogether, in which case, workers would want to fight for them in any case and be pushed towards the revolutionaries. So that was a really path-breaking tactic. I think as a another thing that's important, though, is that informing the resolution of the Comintern to propose the United Front tactic for every party was also the prevalence of ultra-leftism within the ranks of some of the communist parties that they were relating to. So in Italy, but also Germany, which had the contradiction of being the party which had proposed and templated the open letter tactic, Germany was also the place where ultra-leftism had had disastrous consequences for the workers' movement. And ultra-leftism, in the case of Germany, meant things like the March Action, which was about basically saying, we're going to have an insurrection tomorrow based on a flimsy provocation from the state, and basically went out alone. Heaps of members of the Communist Party didn't even go on strike or engage in the struggle that they said was, the revolutionary moment. And they basically cut themselves off from hundreds of thousands of reformist, centrist, and even, potentially at that point, revolutionary workers who would have engaged in struggles but weren't going to throw themselves in the firing line of the German state in a context which was definitely not suited to an uprising. Anyway, so I think the vacillation in Germany within months of the open letter tactic on the one hand being taken up by the leadership and then the March Action codified as the theory of the offensive on the other hand shows there's a sort of vacillation that I think represents the immaturity and problems with the German party, which had been formed just 1 month after the revolution in 1918 began, and which did not have the years of experience and kind of clarity about what their project was in terms of winning workers away from reformism and so on that the Bolsheviks had by the time they were engaging in their struggle. So the sort of patiently explained attitude of Lenin, was not one that was even possible for the German leadership to engage in. Okay, so in terms of the Comintern resolution, I was going to read some passages from it because they're really interesting about how they actually characterised it, but I won't do that because I'm running short of time. But basically, in the key resolution coming out of the 1922 International Congress, they explicitly denounce the idea that the United Front has anything to do with electoral alliances. They also explicitly denounce the idea that it's something that is just applicable in Russia. They say it's something that has to be taken up in every country, in particular countries that have strong reformist institutions. Because it's in those places where the working class is the most under the command of reformist leaders and the tactics that revolutionaries have to engage in to be the clearest in terms of being able to win people from those organisations and expose the political limitations of those organisations. Okay, so just lastly, I want to talk about some of the debates that emerged around the initial congresses discussing the United Front and that have been taken up subsequently. One of them was put forward by the ultra-left, who were very much one of the key audiences for the Comintern leadership in this whole discussion, because they actually wanted to win the ultra-left. They didn't want to just denounce them. They wanted to win them to an understanding that they needed to build alliances with reference workers, etc. But unfortunately, despite the clarity of the resolutions coming out of the Congress, a lot of the delegates at the Congresses didn't particularly understand it. And there was an argument that emerged from a bunch of the ultra-left delegates that they should engage in united fronts from below, which is not something that is particularly relevant today as something that comes up around the left at all. But it's worth saying that that has this sort of left-wing veneer, because what it means is it means go around the reformist leaders, don't talk to the leaders, just talk to the rank and file, the leaders are trash. True, and that would be fine if it worked, but I think Trotsky responded really cuttingly and effectively to say that this ignores the entire premise for the United Front to begin with. We're not engaging in the United Front because we actually think that these organisations are effective tools in the struggle for democracy or this or that concrete demand, but because these reformist leaders have influence over people, and that's why you need to actually make a formal approach, not just to the rank and file, but to the leadership itself. You have to put the leadership on the spot and force them to take a position, because they're the people that the rank and file look to, not you. And also that we do, in revolutionary situations, want to win some of the leaders of these reformist and centrist blocs within the labour movement, that in times of heightened class struggle, some of these leaders can be won around. Okay, another debate, I think it's worth saying at this point that apart from that, all of the opposition to the United Front has traditionally been from the right, and I think that's significant because so much of United Front discussions that I've seen or read about revolve around discussing how to combat ultra-leftism, when in fact the people that were the most staunchly resistant to the United Front tactic being taken up were the right. In particular, the right-wing delegates from the French Party, who later went on to lead a split. These are people who are the classic unity mongers and whatever, to lead a split from the Revolutionary Party in order to reform with the reformists in the Socialist Party of France. They were fiercely hostile to the resolution and gave it a kind of left-wing veneer, but were tactically opposed to it because of how harsh it was about breaking people from reformist organisations and so on. Another thing that has given some credence to right-wing arguments has been the idea that was fudged a little bit in the Congress discussions about united fronts with other classes. So it was discussed, the United Front did get used loosely in some places in the Congress debates to talk about, a United Front, anti-colonial United Front, or a United Front women's movement, which are cross-class alliances. But I think it's important to say that at every moment in these debates in the Comintern, they were absolutely clear that even if you're going to call that some form of a United Front, key within it is the independence of the Revolutionary Party. This is not about the Revolutionary Party making any political overtures to these other forces. And also key to it always was this is about engaging in joint action. I guess the most horrific distortion of the United Front is the People's Front or the Popular Front, which was very much taking this idea of you can form an alliance with other classes and so on. I won't discuss that because we've got a whole session about how that played out in France. But I think that it's important to say that it was basically about blocking with other classes, but in particular the bourgeoisie. Like, it didn't count if the bourgeoisie weren't included. And that it was about blocking with them in the context of an electoral alliance or actual government. In the case of such governments being formed, the argument from the Stalinized communist parties was that the communist party should basically be the loyal supporters of any popular front government that stays true to its aims. Its aims being basically to advance the interests of the country in question, but in a progressive way. So this was about relating to the progressive or left-wing bourgeoisie. So the French leader of the French Communist Party said, upon the results of the election of the Socialist Party, the French Bourgeois Radicals, and the Communist Party in 1936, he said, "We boldly deprived our enemies of the things they'd stolen from us and trampled underfoot. We took back the tricolour and the Marseillaise." So this basically, we are the French nation, was the, you know, the way that these forces understood, you know, front work. Pretty revolting. But I think stepping back from the most reactionary iterations or evolutions of the United Front, to just talk quickly about the concept of engaging in electoral alliances is important, because I think that today is the most common use of the term United Front, and I think it's really wrong. And that was clearly, it was clearly something that the Comintern dismissed as not relevant to the United Front, but is worth going through why. Firstly, because the United Front is not about any political support for organisations, that doesn't mean that revolutionaries don't at times give support to political organisations. We do sometimes call for votes for particular parties or even engage in electoral alliances. But this is not the same as a proposal for united action around a concrete set of demands. Secondly, though, the United Front is about struggle, and I think this explains why it's different to an electoral alliance, because you know, working class people and their organisations engaged in battle against the bourgeoisie, it actually doesn't look like people participating in an election. So elections and political parties contesting elections are definitely shaped by, influenced by the class struggle, and vice versa. The class struggle can be pushed forward by the result of an election, or the kind of demands that a particular, inspiring demands or slogans that a particular party put forward. But the actual process of voting in, for a, you know, a representative in a bourgeois parliament, or handing out how to vote for those figures, that is not engaging in a battle with the bourgeoisie. That is not the class struggle, and I think that's actually an important thing to talk about. One of the ways that electoral alliances get bastardised as a form of the United Front is because of a part of the Comintern debates that revolved around the question of workers' government. I was really interested in this a few years ago, so I wrote a huge amount about this, which I'm not going to have time to talk about. I think I'll just quickly say that the workers' government, the majority of Comintern delegates were very clear, had nothing to do with electoral alliances. The workers' government is a very, very, very specific situation where there's basically a collapse in the bourgeois state, where there's an opening coming out of probably United Front work. There's an opening for a coalition of workers' parties to take over the government and the running of society. Simultaneously, the workers' councils movement is not strong enough to do that for themselves, and instead the political parties have an opportunity to take over. And if they don't, there's going to be a vacuum opened up for the counter-revolutionary forces to regroup and so on. So I think in very particular situations, it is permissible to argue for such a workers' government, but it's important to say that the immediate formation of this government would spell its demise. A workers' government formed at such a high point of class struggle, the communists would argue the job of this government is to arm the working class, is to rebuild, is to build up the workers' councils and Soviets so that they are in a position to govern society for themselves. And all of these things are things that the reformist coalition partners would not agree to. So that was the way that the majority of delegates at the Comintern understood the workers' government proposal. The precedent for it was the 1920 cap putsch in Berlin. The communists actually failed to utilise the opportunity created by that situation, but that was basically an offering from the right-wing trade union leaders to form a workers' government. When the Social Democrats said, we'll do this and we'll dispossess some of the Junker generals from their powerful positions and we'll democratise the state. But this was in conditions of revolutionary conditions, really, where the communists, if they had agreed to that, could have argued the job of this government is to explicitly arm the revolutionary workers, make them the army, and to, you know, allow workers to govern their affairs in every workplace, all those kinds of things. So I think that's something that revolutionaries could engage in. That has nothing to do with, I think you can argue it's it has something to do with the United Front, but it has nothing to do with electoral alliances and some of the other ways that workers' governments or left governments are talked about. Okay, so to just summarise on the question of the United Front, I think that it is the negation of everything passive and sectarian, I guess. It is about saying, like, we want to appeal to the broadest possible forces in the workers' movement, and that we're confident that our program as revolutionaries can do that, that the immediate concrete things that we propose for society are things that accord with the interests of the majority of workers. So join us in this struggle. Reformist leaders should join us in this struggle to fight for more democratic freedoms, against fascism, for higher wages, whatever. It has to be a dialogue between reformists and revolutionaries, which happens at all levels. So not just the rank and file, but also the leadership, the cadre, and so on. And so I think that because it has to be about that, it can only happen when the revolutionary left is of a size to be able to pull that off. It can't happen when the revolutionary left is just this tiny, dinky little group of people involved in some massive reformist party campaign or whatever. And so that's why the United Front basically can't apply anywhere in the world today. And I think the last thing to say is that again and again, it's important to emphasise, as they did at the Comintern discussions, that the United Front is about unity in action. And that once united action with reformists has begun, basically all the chips are in the revolutionary left's corner. We're our best when we're in action, when we're making arguments for how society can be pushed forward by working class people. When workers take action, that's when their consciousness starts to shift as well. And so immediately that you're engaged in that kind of united action, the reformists are on stand. Their kind of arguments and platitudes and reliance on passivity can no longer hold. All right, well, I just wanted to read an excerpt from the thesis on tactics that was the kind of resolution coming out of the fourth Congress of the Comintern, so 1922, because it's very clear and interesting. It starts by saying, the existence of independent communist parties and their complete freedom of action in regard to the bourgeoisie and also the counter-revolutionary social democracy is the most significant historical achievement of the proletariat, which communists in those circumstances renounce. So this is the biggest step forward that we've ever made, is to recognise the necessity of the split between the reformists and revolutionaries. I think that is the way to understand the United Front. Without that, and often it's not talked about in that context, it has no meaning really, except that it's nice morally or, you know, whatever, on some abstract level, for forces to be united. And then it goes on to say, only communist parties fight for the interests of the proletariat in its entirety. The United Front tactic does not mean upper-level electoral alliances which pursue some parliamentary purpose or other. The United Front tactic is the offer for a joint struggle of communists with all workers who belong to other parties or groups, and with all non-party workers, in defence of the basic interests of the working class against the bourgeoisie. And then it goes on to say the way in which you engage in negotiations with the leaders. But I think it's really important to understand that the United Front, it's not just, it happens in the context of the split between reformists and revolutionaries, but the whole purpose then is to make good on that split by growing the revolutionary forces and undermining the reformist forces. That the reason for the split is because only the revolutionary road can actually get us to socialism. The reformist road ends up a defence of capitalism, and so you need to find ways to organise your forces as the revolutionary left that can actually accomplish that task. The United Front immediately services that objective because it's based on the revolutionary forces being big enough to actually, in the course of united activity of the working class, split people away from the reformists or make serious headway in terms of leading a political argument with workers influenced by reformist organisations that lays the basis for a bigger revolutionary left. So outside of situations where the revolutionary left is big enough to accomplish that, I don't think it's right to refer to it specifically as the United Front, even though it can share some same characteristics. So we could, there can be lots of times where working class organisations fight for the interests of the working class in a positive way, in a temporary alliance that is about completing some sort of action that defends us. So the Work Choices movement or whatever was a positive step forward, I guess, you know, it's contradictory, but it was a positive step forward because it was workers in action defending themselves against a government attack. And I think a lot of the time, well, not a lot of the time, some of the time, the revolutionary left can be in a position, say in the UK or Australia today, where it can potentially propose an argument to reformist organisations that they take up and they run with, or that correlates with something they were already invested in doing. So sometimes reformist organisations will engage in some sort of positive struggle that actually pushes things forward in terms of the class struggle. That's positive, and that's a separate tactic. Like arguing in our newspaper, the ACTU should do this or that or whatever, you know, the way to actually change the rules is to break the rules. That's its own tactic. It doesn't become the United Front unless out of the course of that action, we can actually win people who are, you know, masses of people who are under the influence of those reformist parties. So it has some things in common because at one level it does progress the same aim. So when workers actually engage in struggles, so in Australia today, if we had succeeded in having a useful class struggle battle against the bourgeoisie about industrial rules, it does, the people engaging in struggle opens them up to revolutionary politics much more than not engaging in struggle being passive. But it's not an immediate translation in terms of people draw a conclusion out of this struggle, which is, you know, we need more strikes and more struggle against the bourgeoisie, and then they're won to the revolutionary left, because the revolutionary left isn't visible and big enough to be able to do that. So I think that it's important with the United Front tactic not to say that we don't use things from it to understand other tactics and understand the role of reformism and understand the kind of slogans that we should put up. Sometimes we might put up slogans in our paper that are exactly the slogans that you would use when proposing a United Front. But to actually refer to it as a United Front, I think it has to be the revolutionary left is big enough to actually capitalise on that period of activity and win people directly from it.
Well, thank you, Sarah.